your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
If I were starting over, on my short list of careers that would intrigue me would be composer of music for Hollywood films. But what's it really like to be a film composer? Well, I'm privileged to have a preeminent one on the show with us now. He's done orchestrations for Paul McCartney, Barry Manilow, Marvin Hamlisch, won the Tony Award for Book of Mormon, 5 Emmys, 7 Tony nominations, including for Spamalot, Fiddler on the Roof, and the 2017 revival of Hello, Dolly. I want to say hello now to Larry. Larry Hochman, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for honoring us with your presence here.
No, please. Thanks for having me on. I'm very interested to hear back from all these people, but I guess it's I'll only hear from you, and it's one way.
All right. You know, now I'm hearing a little bit of static or whatever. Is there some issue with your phone or something?
Oh, God, I hope not.
Now you're sounding better, so...
Oh, okay. You know what? I think somebody once told me, hit the phone and it works better. I just smacked it and I gave it a good zit.
You see, this already provides tremendous insight. Here you are, Mr. Music, Mr. Sound, and even your phone requires the technological wizardry of slamming it so that it'll work.
Yeah, and to find the portable besides that.
Yes.
I have a beautiful set of 4 portable phones that I got as a Father's Day gift, and 2 of them are now lost.
Well, that is one of the issues, you know, can't find my keys, can't find my phones, that's just the way life goes. All right, I should get serious at least for a moment. So, speaking of moment, what was the first moment you thought you'd become a film composer?
Oh, that's a good one. God, was it as far back as seeing something like Spartacus, or... There was a point in my youth where I really... got the idea that the music behind the talking, behind the action, makes you feel, well, it's because you're not there in 3 dimensions and you're viewing it on a screen, somehow the background score it guides your emotions to what you're supposed to feel.
No question. There's no question about that. Were you a musician, dude, or were you more just a listener? You know, what's your musical background?
It was always from the music side. I was playing piano from when I was kindergarten or before
right. That,
I think.
Me too.
I don't really remember that far back.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, it's funny, by 7 or 8, I already had pretty good, you know, beginning classical skills. I had been taking lessons, and I had already tinkered on writing some piano music. And then I picked up guitar, and luckily it was just before the Beatles came out, so I was all prepared for that. I didn't have to try to learn guitar in a hurry like everyone else seemed to. So, but the point is that by the time I heard, for me, the coming of age, my coming of age in the era of the Beatles and early rock and roll,
mm-hmm,
and some of the early folk groups, it was lucky because the timing was such that I already had a facility on piano and guitar, and I sang to the best that I sing, so I could be involved in, you know, in those kind of, you know, local opportunities or playing in groups with friends. But back to your question, I was at the point that I was noticing, how the music worked on a TV show or in a movie. I did already have the sense of the music.
But how does a piano player and a guitar player go from that to being able to orchestrate for bassoon and woodwinds and strings and, you know, and timpani? How did you go to that, to get to that level?
That's a good question. It's funny, a lot of it was in a particular book that I read. I mean, at the point that I wanted to know how it all worked and, you know, how is it possible to write write lines for 70 instruments? Well,
right.
Actually, it's not that complicated because they are in families. I mean, it's complicated, believe me. But it's not writing 70 different parts. But how are they organized? Well, someone steered me towards this book on orchestration by Walter Piston. And this was in my high school years, and reading the book, looking at the musical examples, and then spending all my money on records and scores, and just following along with in the full scores and listening to records, and chapter by chapter.
It's a great way to learn.
But it made sense to me, and enough that I kept reading and kept wanting to hear more music. At that point, my favorites, I believed, would always be Bach and Debussy and the Beatles, and it was that narrow. Mm. And a little by little, I remember the day that I discovered Richard Strauss, and I think that was from a Leonard Bernstein Young People's concert. And then he talked about Respighi. Somehow, exponentially, my interests, which still stayed in the 19th and 20th century classical and still pop music, but so in a sense, in those narrow areas, in other words, not the old classical and not so much the Baroque, but in the particular areas that I was most interested in, it grew exponentially within that.
Okay, I want to interrupt you. You know, what I want to jump to this. What seems you learn the way that I learn most things, including music, which is you're reading, trying it out, doing it, following along, listening to my. When I was a kid, it was the hi-fi and trying to play along. But you have both. You went to Manhattan School of Music, so you had the formal music training, and you had this, you know, what they call the autodidact, self-teaching approach. As you look back, now that you've won Tonys and Emmys and lots of Emmy nominations, to what extent did each of those two learning modes inform your being an A-list, very A-plus list, composer, you know, arranger, orchestrator?
You're very kind. But I think now that I look back, I see that, yes, I went to Manhattan School of Music and have a degree there, and yet the aha moments were particular moments with a teacher here or there or a particular insight that I got. And then I look back in the way that I organize the sound and organize the instruments, that's on the technical level. But when I hear a melody on piano, or let's say someone gives me a melody that has to be arranged, when I hear the other layers around it to form an accompaniment in my head, that doesn't happen because I've read a book or heard something from a teacher. It's the instinct side.
Right. So something like this, I'm going to guess. So let's say, you know, you hear a melody and you say, geez, would this sound best if it was played by oboe or violin as a lead? And I think it would be really, really good if we use an English horn on the bottom, and in the middle we might have some the viola section. Is it like that?
It kind of is. Sometimes I'll hear a melody, you know, played, and I'll immediately think, oh, that's the violin. So, but sometimes it's more often I'm thinking, boy, I just don't know. I could hear it so many, and I just think about it. I mean, I'll listen in my head. You know, if it were an oboe, it would sound like this, and if it were a flute, and usually, then I convince myself that I have no idea what I'm doing, and not sure why I got hired, and that I'll probably get fired. And once I get past that, I sometimes have a good idea.
Dear listeners, take that in. You know, the most successful people I know, I have been a career counselor to some of the most successful people on the planet and some real strugglers. And you know what? The successful ones are the warriors. They think they're incompetent, and that fuels them to say, oh my God, I better redo this, or I better be on my best behavior, or it's not going to work. Listen to this guy who's won Tony Awards, who's won Emmy Awards, and he was worried he's not good enough to get hired.
Well,
winners don't have to.
I was talking about that with someone tonight, but I remembered a story. I was working on Scottsboro Boys, which was a wonderful show. John Kander, Fred Epp, who had, you know, they wrote Cabaret, they wrote Floor of the Red Menace. You know, they have their bag of successes, and I got to know John Kander once I started feeling comfortable with him. We were chatting, and I didn't know if I should admit this, but I kind of admitted that I'm not, you know. When he was saying, you know, what do you think you'll do in this song? And I'm thinking that I'm really not sure yet. And he puts his hand on my shoulder. I remember he looks at me. He says, "Larry, I never wrote a show that I knew how to write."
Wonderful line. Wonderful line.
And I thought, I've been thinking that for 40 years, but he said it the best.
Exactly. So, anyway, yeah, you're listening to work. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, reiterating, it's exactly what true what you're saying. I know so many people that have the same feeling.
Absolutely.
A couple of people I know, I think that they actually know what it should be as soon as they look at it. And, I mean, maybe one's Mozart, and maybe he's the only one. But I was in a discussion. I remember a book I read in college as part of the class. It was called The Creative Process. And they were contrasting the, Mozart would be riding in a carriage and get an idea for a piano concerto, and it's all but written in a fraction of a second, and he'll write it down later when he feels like it. And Beethoven was agonizing over every bar, and his notebooks were full of crossouts, more crossouts than there are notes. And Mozart had no sketches; it was just a final product. So everyone's different.
Yeah. Now I would guess the modern day version of Beethoven or Mozart in your genre would be John Williams. So when I say, do you know about John Williams's process?
I actually don't. No.
Okay. Anyway, listen.
I thought you were going to tell me.
No, I don't know. No, I'm having a conversation, like we're having a beer together.
I wish I did know. My hero in recent years, although we've lost him, is Jerry Goldsmith. He was over the last generation, he was my favorite film composer. But
why?
Then there's also Alan Silvestri.
Why?
God, I just remember his scores to Poltergeist and The Planet of the Apes, and thought it was so far outside the box. I would try to imagine the picture without sound, and I marvel at how did someone think of that solution for the picture.
Mm. This is kind of stupid that we're having this conversation about music. We haven't played any music. So we're going to be doing some of your music. But let me let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Larry Hockman. He's not just any film composer. He won the Tony Award for Book of Mormon, 5 Emmys, 7 Tony nominations, he's wrote and done orchestrations for Paul McCartney, Barry Manilow, Marvin Hamlisch. This is not chopped liver. So,
I don't even like chopped liver. Don't tell
who
my
does?
Grandmother.
Nobody likes chopped liver. It's just something you do anyway, or some people do. It's pate. Pate with less frou-frou. Anyway, the first clip is a clip from Spamalot that you were nominated for an Emmy or Tony or whatever the hell it was. And why don't you say 30 seconds about what we as listeners should be either listening for or whatever.
Okay.
About this.
I will tell you that Spamalot, music by Eric Idle and John Dupre, lyrics by Eric Idle, with two exceptions, or three exceptions, and one of them is, this is one of the exceptions, because it is a version of Knights of the Round Table, which was in the whole Monty Python, the Holy Grail, and the other collaborators are all the other Pythons, I think, and Neil Innes. So it was a committee song. I realized I have a great story. It has to do with what Michael Nichols said on the first day of rehearsal.
Go ahead.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah,
should I say this before or after?
Before.
You
do it before.
Okay. Well, the first day of rehearsal, he says, "We're not going to play this for comedy. We're going to play this in all seriousness, in all sincerity." And throughout the following days, when I was really agonizing over what kind of sound should this be, should this be a funny sound, should I be pointing out, should the instrument sound like Spike Jones making comments here and there, and I realized, I remembered what Mike Nichols said, and I thought it was just the wisest thing about comedy that I ever heard, and long after that, I thought back on Spamalot and realized that the musical score is the straight man in the comedy. And I, for the most part, you won't hear the orchestra sounding like they're playing funny sounds. They're just sounding like they're trying to be in a Broadway show, which is what the whole plot of it is. So the Knights of the Round Table in the setting of Spamalot is when they see that it wasn't the set wasn't an illusion of Camelot, but they find themselves in Las Vegas at the gambling tables. And then the Lady of the Lake comes out. They think she's a knight in shining armor, but then it turns out to be a beautiful lady. And everything is full of mismatches. But the score is just, it all sincerity, a Broadway show.
So a question is that, you know, you said that Eric Idle and somebody else composed it. You were the arranger and orchestrator, is that correct in this? So,
right.
And this is probably a good time to explain. No, those are different terms that I love, under-the-radar careers. Everybody knows about film composer. What is what's the difference between an orchestrator and an arranger?
Well, I'm sorry, the orchestrator, arranger. Okay, and here there's yet another arranger who is Glenn Kelly. Glenn Kelly took Eric's songs and made them into playable piano parts and also formatted and stylized the music to match the dance routines and the staging so that from beginning to end it timed out and matched everything that the choreography and action has to handle. So if I get a sketch that's 200 bars long, I'm going to come back with an orchestra score that has a staff for every instrument that is also 200 bars long. But there's also a lot of area in the sound, you might call it sound painting or sound structuring, because I don't just transfer the notes that Glenn Kelly writes on the page from the piano part and figure, oh, that left-hand note should be a bassoon, this right-hand note should be a trumpet. There's no need to get too technical, but there's a kind of shift and to be, even though I'm trying to be faithful to the piano part, there's still room to add layers of sound and lines, meaning counterpoint lines, and I'm trying to convey the thought without being too technical. I don't change the bass line, I don't change the rhythm, but I might think, oh, well, maracas would be better here than bongos. Should it have a guitar? Should it not have a guitar? So there are 100 choices in every phrase, but I try to keep in mind the big picture, the broad strokes, and where the money section is, and how to get the build and the climax, and still make it fit the choreography and the vocals.
Okay, I've picked out this one is the longest clip of the three we're gonna do. This is a minute and a half, but I loved it so much I couldn't make it shorter. So let's now hear a clip from Spamalot, the work that you were a major contributor to in one way or another.
Pramalot.
Okay, Larry, the composer, arranger, orchestrator, or whatever it is, what were you feeling or thinking as you were listening to your work?
I'll tell you, just now I was remembering that I against the saxophones, which are contemporary Broadway, and xylophone, I also said, well, it's Middle Ages, I should use recorder and crumb horn, and they're not supposed to, they shouldn't blend, and in fact they don't blend, but I guess that was the point also, and I was amused.
You're listening
were you asking what I was thinking when I was just listening to it, or when I worked on it originally?
Either way, what you're listening right now is you were listening, looking back.
I remember on the third day I was working on the song, and I called the conductor, Todd Ellison, brilliant, by the way, and I said, Todd, I feel so badly. I might be behind schedule, but I'm still working on this song. And he says, are you kidding? He said, that song is like four songs in one. It's the majority of the first act. So I felt better, and it did all get done on time somehow.
All right, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I am talking with a truly, you know, they always use the word even award-winning has cheapened in recent years. But this guy is the real deal. It's not like he won the Topeka, Kansas third place in the regional 14-year-old competition. The guy won the Tony Award for Best Book of Mormon. He's a composer, he orchestrator, arranger. 5 Emmys, 7 Tony nominations. He has written orchestrations for Paul McCartney, Barry Manilow, Marvin Hamlisch. He's Spamalot, Fiddler on the Roof, all of that stuff. Anyway, let me ask you, let me go in a different direction here. In the last, you know, we're talking traditional instruments. When I go see a lot of regional theater, and there's a lot of use of synthesizers, and that's a very obvious way in which technology has changed the biz. In what ways, technological and otherwise, has the world of film or video game or commercial production, composing or whatever, changed?
When I first had to present demos to ad agencies, when we did the earlier commercials, Toys R Us was the first time I got a national commercial. That was when I was in the jingle business with my late partner Larry Gates and best friend. We had to present ideas on just a few instruments because, you know, there was a low budget for a demo, and we used, you know, piano, bass, and we had some of the early synthesizers, so we'd get a little bit of richness in it just by, you know, playing a little, we would say a pad, you know, chording behind the rhythm section. But in the later, this was back in 81, in later years, the synthesizers were much more sophisticated. And, of course, synthesizers started off with being able to make sounds that acoustic instruments cannot. What was surprising is that over the next decade, the synthesizers evolved to the point that they could imitate to a somewhat of a degree, some people think a complete degree, but, you know, somewhat sounding like the acoustic instrument, and then the digital sampling synthesizers came out so that they actually were playing back, in essence, a recording segment by segment of time of actually playing back the attack of a violin and the sustain of a violin. It's never the same as real instruments, but they were great for demonstration purposes when there's no budget at all to show what the eventual product was. But we never thought that these synthesizers were going to start replacing acoustic instruments. We were still, when we did the final, we still had a 28-piece orchestra, and in the case of Kodak commercials, we had a 30 or 40-piece orchestra, and that's changed. Now, often, even for a final, the question is, well, how many real instruments do you really need, and the rest you'll do on synthesizer, and it's depressing to a degree.
How many musicians, so in the modern-day equivalent of that 30-piece orchestra at a Kodak commercial, if I was doing a Toyota commercial today, how many live instrument musicians would be hired for the gig?
Well, maybe three.
Wow.
Maybe five, maybe none.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons that I'm happy to be out of the jingle business as of the mid-90s.
Oh, my God.
I know I could tell you in the more practical side from the Broadway, from the theatrical end of things, only because I haven't done commercials in a long time. Spamalot could have been done very successfully with a 25 to 28 piece orchestra in the pre-synthesizer days, and we had 17, which was pretty good. And in fact, I did need synthesizer for some special sounds. And occasionally, there's, you know, the Lady of the Lake comes out, and it needs to sound like a Wagner opera for 10 seconds, and then go into the Laker. The joke is that the Lady of the Lake has her Laker girls, so now we're in the sound of a halftime at a football game.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a tuba and sousaphones and piccolos. Well, certainly you can't have a marching band, the equivalent of a marching band and a Wagner opera in a pit. So synthesizers really are legitimately mm-hmm. placed. And as I say, 17 pieces is not too bad. We had.
Does the union fight you? I mean, unions are always about protecting jobs. Does 802, which is the musicians' union I was in New York, does the union fight to have more live musicians?
Oh, yeah. Three different times in the time period that I had been a pit player, and in fact, that probably was the first occurrence where the there's a listing for each theater of how many musicians have
mm-hmm,
to be hired.
Mm-hmm.
Except for extenuating circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And every time there's a contract renewal, or not every time, but many, as I say, several times over the years, even to the point of there being a strike, that's been challenged by the producers. I happen to be, I actually lost my job in 1975 because the minimum for the Winter Garden was 26. And we were out of town with Pacific Overtures, and by the time we came back into town, the minimum had been negotiated down to 25, and they cut out the keyboard, which was me.
Huh. You know, we're talking to you. Let's listen to another cut. I'm gonna play the clip from, this is a shorter clip, half a minute, from The Adventurers. This is something you wrote in addition to orchestrated, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about that.
Yeah, and again, the clip that we heard from Spamalot and all the other shows on Broadway that I've been nominated for, I was the orchestrator, not the composer.
And again, what's the difference between an orchestrator and arranger? Is there a difference?
There's a big overlap, and an orchestrator is, well, arranging can be anything from routining a song and deciding when it goes up a half step and when it goes into, when you put the cymbals in for the kicks.
Mm-hmm.
And orchestrating is a type of arranging, but it's the final step where you're actually writing out the parts for every instrument that's going to be playing, and the end product has to be a separate part for every instrument in
right.
the orchestra.
And so the composer could simply be writing it for piano, and then he turns it over to the orchestrator / arranger
yes.
for the gig. Okay, tell right. him, give me a few seconds
so
about.
I think it's interesting that you know, as a film composer, which was my aspiration, and
mm-hmm.
I got the chance to work on a couple of films, a couple of documentaries, a couple of small films, and a great TV series for Nickelodeon, The Wonder Pets. But I never got, I mean, I'm not known for the big major film scores. However, I had a great success in working for a company that produces records as library music that get used in anything from movies to commercials to in any field where you need music immediately. Like, let's say something happened on the news and they need something right now, they're
got
not going to commission John Williams. So there are libraries of stock music,
right.
It's sometimes called. And I got to write about eight CDs worth of themes just of my own devising. And one collection was Americana music, one was Hollywood music, and this one is from what I called my Hollywood music collection. And it's an homage to, I think this would be closest to the score, for instance, Robin Hood by Eric Korngold.
Mm-hmm.
So this is evoking the earliest of the grand Hollywood scores, and I did have 65 pieces in the orchestra.
Wow. Okay, let's take a listen.
Thank you.
Okay, again, so what were you feeling as the guy who created this? How are you feeling as you were listening to it right now this second?
Oh, I remember it was a cold winter day, and my daughter, who was 1 year old, was sleeping upstairs. It was probably 5 in the morning, and I was behind the deadline and just had to write 5 more compositions, and I was downstairs in the basement. It was cold. I could just picture the whole thing, and then I had this idea that reminded me I thought of Errol Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, now I've written some kitschy pieces that are off the beaten path, and now I want to try to think of a melody that is that old Hollywood sound. And I wouldn't want to use the word generic, but I'm trying to use it in a good way.
Yeah.
I want it to be right in the middle of the road.
Broadly applicable.
And make you feel like you're Saturday afternoon at the cinema.
Right.
In 1942, which I have no idea what it was like in the cinema in 1942. But my mother would.
Right. Let's do one more. This one's called American Ballad. Give me a little quick introduction to that.
Oh, over the years, I worked for Pushcart Players, which creates and tours shows for young audiences, and they go around to all the schools, and they got to be friends of mine throughout all these years. I've arranged about 21 shows for them, and some of them were composed by me as well, some by Carol Wechter. This one was the first time that I was the composer for one of their shows. It was called Dear America, and about 5 years after that, when I was asked to do an Americana series for Carlin Recorded Music Library, I did an expansion of this, both in terms of changing it from a 10-piece orchestra into a 60-piece orchestra, but also changing the form of it. I added a whole middle section, and this got to be, of my stock music, this has been probably the most widely used piece. There was a time that I remember I would see it on a TV commercial for the Saturn car, as well as it was on a commercial for Old Navy.
I love it.
And it was on a commercial for Pam Food Spray.
I love it.
And then someone told me they heard it on the Yankee, is it called the Yankeeography? Some documentary. But it pops up here and there, so you might even find it familiar.
I love it. Let's listen.
But for me, it's just...
Dude, I got to tell you, it does sound generic. Good generic, but generic.
Well, it's an E-flat, and it has French horns and strings.
Right. Hey, you know, switching back to the career thing, you know, one of the things that you hear all the time about anybody who wants a career in Hollywood is how political it is. It's who you know, who you know, who you know. To what extent, from your experiences, was your personality, schmoozing, parties, all that crap, was relevant to your success?
Well, I would say I'm going to answer it in the opposite.
Okay.
In that, I'm not a good schmoozer. Mm. I'm not good at finding where the party is.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the reasons that I didn't get established in L.A.
Mm.
Because I did a couple of projects there. I worked on 2 of the episodes of Spielberg's Amazing Stories. And I met the director, Paul Bartel. I met a couple of people. It wasn't part of my DNA to try to claw at the right people. And even though those were good experiences, they seemed to be isolated, and I just found myself drawn back to New York, where I just was more comfortable here. So, did I have the right agent? Probably not. Was I at the right party? Who knows? It's very mysterious to me, and it really there really is no there out there. I found that to be true, but I kind of didn't have a direction as far as where to go to try to get the jobs. I sent out the reel, I edited my video reel, and I guess there are any movie company has three movies, and they have 80 composers that submit reels to them. When I say reels, I mean, you know,
yeah,
a video reel or a show reel, as the English would say.
Yeah. So,
but I also knew that I was very happy working in theater. I'd be very happy working in film. I was very happy working in commercials, and very grateful if I would get enough work in any of those fields. So when I got offers to work more in the studio business in New York, and then eventually got more theater jobs, I mean, I was perfectly happy to, as I say, to be established and to get consistent work in any field. And in fact, in the 80s, before I started to get more theatrical projects, I was doing this. It was a mishmash. I mean, one day I'd be playing piano for a dance rehearsal, another I'd be coaching a singer, and another day I'd be doing a movie of the week orchestrations for Irwin Fish or something. So and the composite of all the gigs over a year were, there was plenty of work. And in fact, I used to joke that because I didn't get to play piano for the big hits, but rather either a flop or subbing for somebody that had a hit, it turns out by nature of that, I didn't get stuck in one Broadway pit for 5 years. I worked for a different conductor every week.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting very spread out in the New York scene, but not the L.A. scene.
So that's what brings us actually full circle. The show's about career. Let's say somebody did aspire. There's a lot of musicians here in the Bay Area, and a lot of them who would love to make a living at it. If I was your brother, and I was saying, you know, I'd love to be a film composer, a video game composer, even I'm willing to do jingles or whatever, what advice would you have for me that is not obvious?
Okay, well, what I have said to people is how a woman said, oh, I want you to help my son because he's trying to get work. You had your career so well directed. What did you do? I said, all I did was answer the phone when it rings, and I said yes. And I don't mean that cynically, but the flip side of that, because people have said, oh, don't you need to be lucky and to be at the right place at the right time? And my answer is yes, and I did get my lucky breaks, but the thing is I would encourage you all, whoever you are, do your homework, learn, you know, study, if you're in music, study the classics, study jazz, study whatever the areas that you're drawn to. Be prepared so that when you get that lucky break and someone says, oh, could you, you know, you've been playing piano, can you conduct, or can you do a chart, that's not the time you want to learn on the job. Take a conducting lesson. Look at some scores before you're in the position of having to say yes or no, I can't or can do an orchestration.
Larry, but in the real world, there's a million musicians who are sitting in their apartment and they could wait, and the only guy they're ever going to hear from is going to be the pizza delivery guy. You know, they're not in a position where they're being, hey, can you conduct? I hear, you know, take the more typical person today who's sitting in Oakland, California in his apartment or her apartment, and is, you know, he's a good musician or she's a good musician and whatever, but all she's doing is playing at the local, at the Octopus Club for 12 people at $25. What, you know, what advice do you have for that person?
Boy, I wish I had some great advice, but I can only tell it from my point of view, and I realized that my last comment, I left out a step, which was that I was a pianist, and I would be perfectly willing to play for, as I say, a dance class or playing for a singer's audition, so that if I was accompanying someone for their audition in a show and they might need a pianist or might need a backup pianist, that's where if you get a job in a pit or a local production of something and you're playing piano, there might be the time that the conductor is out or for the next production they weren't as happy with the conductor as they thought they were, and they ask you, could you also conduct? You want to be able to be prepared enough to say, yes, I can. But as far as how to, you know, yeah, right, the pizza delivery guy, he's not going to offer you a conducting job. Well, I don't know, there is that little bit of luck.
All right, let me tell you my story.
I think you start by not just being a composer. You start by socializing. In other words, playing piano, if you have to play at a bar, that's fine. If you play at a restaurant or you play in a nightclub band, just keep saying yes.
Can I tell you my story? You know, I'm a musician, right? So here is my first gig. My sister was taking tap dancing lessons at Charlie Lowe's tap dancing studio. I was 10 years old. She was like 8. So I go, and my mom is picking her up, and I'm going with her, and I show off that I am. They had a piano player playing music, you know, T for Two or whatever, for the kids to tap. I said, I could do that. And I played, and I got hired at age 11 to play accompanying at Charlie Lowe's tap dancing studio. Next gig, I went bowling by myself. I am not a social guy. I'm bowling, and right across the street from the bowling alley is Stephen Scott Orchestras on Hillside Avenue in Queens. I had the nerve to go in there and say, I want to play for you. He says, yeah, right. Play the Shot of Your Smile in F sharp. Well, I could do that. So I did that, and I got hired, and I played 2,000 weddings and bar mitzvahs from that. So it takes a certain amount of chutzpah in my judgment. What do you think about that?
It does. You reminded me, Eddie Strauss, who we lost just a couple of years ago, he was the pianist in Pippin. That's how when I met him, that's what his gig was on Broadway. He told me that he was accompanying a singer who had an audition, and he just, in other words, they had a pianist du jour playing for everyone's audition, but some of the singers would bring their own accompanist. He was an accompanist, paid $10 to play one song for her. He went in, they liked him so much, they hired him for the show.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward a year into the run, and this is now before I even met Eddie, so I'm in Manhattan School of Music as a senior, and I went to hear a lecture, a guest speaker of Renee Wiegert, who we also lost a few years ago. He was they said he was the conductor of Pippin. So I went to hear him talk, and he was telling us all about Broadway shows. There were only about 20 of us in the class. And he said, don't be afraid, you know, if you want to call a conductor, they're all listed in the book. Just call them up and say you want to audition for them.
Yep.
And so I said he said, but, you know, first you want to play some dinner theater, you want to do some summer stock, you need to, you know, learn your theatrical repertoire, Broadway shows. So I took his advice. I thought to myself, well, he's saying you should be comfortable trying to talk to someone like that. So I said, Mr. Wiegert, after the class, I said, I have done summer stock. I have done dinner theater. I know Broadway show tunes. What else might you be able to tell me? He says, why don't you come down next week to the pit? You can sit
Love
in the
it.
Pit and watch.
Love
and
it.
And then he said, you know, Eddie has to take off a couple of shows next week. Do you think you could learn this?
Love it.
And I just said yes. So it happened. I mean, that was my break.
Love it.
But, I mean, I had done, you know, 10 local shows before that, and every chance I got, even during my classical studies, I would go take out from Lincoln Center the printed score from West Side Story or Candide or Porky and Bess, and I was learning as much as I could. I found a lot of the Broadway songs easy, but I made sure that the ones that were hard, like Sondheim, that I could play those.
Right.
So I practiced the ones that were off the beaten path. And
you mentioned I think the most educational overture you'll ever hear is Candide. And even, you know, Oklahoma's overture is amazingly wonderful. Did you listen to those? Were those particularly instructive for you?
Yeah. I found out something very interesting later on, which is that Bernstein wrote every note of the Candide overture, but the tradition of other composers was that, and I believe this is the case, that Robert Russell Bennett, the orchestrator, one of the tasks that he took on was to write the overture to Oklahoma.
Huh? I see.
I think that applies to many of the early shows. Now, I believe something as intricate as the Carousel Waltz.
Oh, I love that.
Probably
that overture
by Richard Rodgers. So it's not a hard rule one way or the other. But there are definitely the times where an orchestrator had the honor, let's say, of writing the overture.
You know what I want to do? Before I let you go, I've got two things I'm going to torture you with. I want to give our dear listeners a chance to bring us back to reality about life as a musician. If you, dear listeners, are a musician, first of all, let our listeners know what you're listening to. Listen to Work with Marty Nemco. We do a semi-regular feature on the show called What's It Really Like to Be A? We've done everything from psychiatrists to prostitutes. Well, today we're doing somebody who's not a prostitute, but a real legitimate film composer, a guy who has done orchestrations for Paul McCartney, Barry Manilow, Marvin Hamlisch, one Tony Tony Award for Book of Mormon, 5 Emmys, 7 Tony nominations, Larry Hockman. If you want to hock Larry right now on the phone, you can give a call. The phone number here, work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. I especially want to hear from you if you are a musician and have something that you want to ask or tell in light of having listened to this about what it's really like to be a music composer. 415-841-4134. And while we wait for the calls to come in, I only do this, regular listeners to the show know, with guests I really like. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm a career counselor. That's what I do. Now, you're not a spring chicken anymore, and you've got all the acclaim, you've done everything. If I were your career counselor, and let's say I could cover any issue, everybody's got an issue until they're in the box. Before you're in the pine box, is there a career issue you would like to run by me? And I will do what I do on the radio with people, which is I do these things called workovers. I ask you questions, whatever, and we try to come up with a baby step to move forward. Do you have a career issue you want to run by me?
Me?
Yeah, you.
I wish I could. I mean, I'll tell you, over the past couple of years, I've gotten so many offers for work, and so much work, and I still am of the mindset that I'm terrified to not say yes. I have to, you know, like if I turn down a job, like they'll never call me again.
Right, I understand that.
And I truly would like to work on a normal schedule and not a crazy schedule. Mm. And then, of course, as soon as I say that, then the phone stops ringing. But I would like to have more of, I would like to direct more myself of which hours I work and which months I can take off.
Do you really want to have a rule of thumb like saying, I'm going to turn down this kind of job? I'll take these and I'm not going to take those, or is that not quite it? Would you really deep down you like being over in demand and don't like turning things down? What really deep down, Larry Hockman, the human being?
I think it's the latter. I think I really don't want to be getting things that I have to say no to.
And so you're saying that you just be grateful and say yes to everything, and so you're at most of the
yeah,
most.
I wish I could say yes to everything, but that there were 20% less things coming in.
And what? And is there a way in which, do they just come in sitting by the phone, or is there do you market yourself in some way that you could market yourself in a way that would restrict what came in?
No, I haven't marketed myself at all.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Right. How about your agent? Look, you said you got the wrong agent.
No. That was an agent that tried to be an agent for 10 minutes, probably 2 years. I sunk too much money in it. No, I have Mark Sendroff who negotiates contracts for me, but I don't have an agent that procures work.
Mm-hmm. And looking, so let me probe it this way in terms of something that you, if God forbid you had one gig left before you died and suddenly you were going to get run over by a bus, what would
don't say that.
I know.
I was in a car accident. It's a little close to home.
All right, okay, all right. Well, beamed up to planet Pluto. Would be the one gig that you'd want to do that you haven't yet done that would be the coolest thing that Larry Hockman, who's gotten all of the success, what would he do? One gig.
A feature film, an adventure film, a Spielberg film.
There we go. So what if I said to you, darling, you need to make a custom reel and send it to his music, whoever his music producer, executive producer is, because you don't want to go into the good night without giving that at least a shot.
It's a great idea.
I'll quit while I'm ahead.
And I could make that reel with, I have enough to put on it.
There you go. So, and then the only thing I ask in return is if you get to do it, I want to come to the opening night screening. I'll fly down to Hollywood. What do you think?
And we'll have chopped liver.
And we'll have chopped liver.
It's a date, Marty.
Larry Hockman, it was indeed a play. I told you we would have fun. Yes, was it fun? Truthfully.
And I believed you didn't let me down a bit.
Right. It was a joy. Larry Hockman, thanks very much for being my guest on Work With
Marty. Marty, the pleasure was mine. Thank you so much.
All right. Be well. Bye. We have just 10 minutes, but I want to devote it, as I usually do, to try to focus on you. This is all well and good for me to talk about, you know, the career of film composer, but very few are going to be film composers. You might find it interesting, you might not, but your career is interesting, especially to you. If you've got a work-related problem of any sort, unemployed, well-employed, and still unhappy, 16 or 76, for-profit or non-profit, I've been doing this show 28 and a half years, I've heard it all. And the more challenging the problem, the better. You got a work problem, love to hear it. This is my pro bono work. I do it for you, and thanks to KLW, and we're making it happen here for you. So if you would like what I call a workover, just give a call. The phone number, this is a great time to call when the lines are available, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls, I want to tell you a little anecdote happened today with a client who is a true insider in Silicon Valley. He started out as a programmer, and then he became a software lead and an architect, and he's now an executive, and he's worked at a number of companies in his 40s, and he knows everybody, and he is really in the belly of the beast. And so I asked him, because I'm always trying, you know, especially when a guy is as experienced as he is, and we are in a tech-centric world, I say, you know, we end up hearing in the media all the time about how we need to have more people who major in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, more computer science majors. And if you're already out of college, you need to go to these boot camps, these high-tech boot camps, and that's key. And you know what what he said? It's a scam. He said, in the real world of Silicon Valley, it's not that we, you know, the media again talks about the H-1B visas, you know, we have all these amendments. They don't use the H-1B visas very much. They use some of them. What they really do, for most of the coding that's basic, it gets done in Vietnam for $5 an hour. And for the really hard stuff, $25 an hour in India, China, Israel, Ireland. That's the reality, at least his reality. And it's, you know, he has a wealth of experience. So, sure, if you're a rock star coder, programmer, you've been programming since you were parturition, since you were a fetus, fine. But if you're just, you know, you're figuring, oh, there's the holy grail of the dollars are in programming, you're wrong. You know where the dollars are today? The dollars are in government jobs, because that is the one area that continues to grow in Republican and Democrat administrations alike. And it's one of the last bastions of fully benefited, often unionized, full-time, security of employment, even a pension. I mean, that's an atavistic term. It's a term out of the 19th century. And yet they have government, thanks to the taxpayer, they have pensions. That is a great... The only problem is I had a guest, you know, it was last week on the show. It could take 6 to 18 months to get hired. But if you've got the luxury of time, especially a federal job, is probably... You know, and yes, look, we all know there's some legitimacy to the fact that the government is very bureaucratic and things don't move as nimbly as a startup with the Red Bull and the ping pong tables in the office. But there's a lot to be said for government work, not to mention the ideology, especially many people here in the Bay Area have nonprofit sensibilities. And they like the idea, they believe that the government does a good job of serving the commonweal. And so that's really where the jobs are. Also, yes, in healthcare, which we've been saying for decades, of course, because yes, the boomers are aging. But the I'm less enamored of that because, you know, it sounds, when you say the word healthcare, it's antiseptic, pardon the pun. But in the reality, you're dealing with sick people in pain all the time. I have a client who's a physical therapist. And it's very hard for her. Her job is to help people regain range of motion. To regain their range of motion, they've got to push beyond where they can, and that means pain. So she's experiencing dealing with pain every day, all day. And so healthcare, whether you're a nurse in med-surg in a hospital, or you're a doctor dealing with very many non-compliant patients and all the paperwork, healthcare, yes, plenty of jobs, relatively speaking. But I'm really, the more I've been at this game and I see the world changing, and I would not have said this when I started as a career counselor 30 years ago. It's government is the answer. And I'm not just talking. There's my daughter works for the government. She makes a very nice salary, thank you. And she's got regular hours and really likes her job. And, you know, government is so varied. There's 2 million government employees, not counting the military, not counting the post office. So there's all kinds. Once you're in the system, there's unlimited opportunities for lateral moves to other kind of agencies and other kind of problems. So that's my message to you. I have time for one call. Let's take a call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, I was just listening to your show. I enjoy it. My name is Leslie Chin, and I'm a freelance musician.
Uh-huh.
So So I thought I would just call in, and I don't know if I have a question necessarily, but for musicians who are wondering about how to get some work, I had a little bit of advice.
Great.
I don't know if you...
Love it.
I think one important thing is we get a lot of work from our colleagues. So mm-hmm. I think people have to remember to be good colleagues.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Tell me what that looks like for you. What do you do to make to be a good colleague?
Show up on time and be prepared. If you have music, if you were lucky enough to get music to practice ahead of time, learn it. If you're playing a show, I've played in many Broadway pits, mm-hmm. and I play in regional mm-hmm. orchestras mm-hmm. all over the area. Mm-hmm. You know, listen to the. Often they'll send you a recording of the show that's going around. So listen to the recording, play along with it, learn your part, and everybody else is around you. Because often there's not a lot of time for rehearsal now.
Right.
So.
You know what's so interesting is this is such like elementary stuff. Be prepared and show up.
Yes.
And yet, you know, in this crazy world in which we live, where many people, especially disproportionately in the arts,
yes.
you know, they use the term flakiness, not, you know, along with artists for a reason, because a lot of people just don't show up. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people they underestimate how small your chance might be. I think another good thing to do is be a good sight reader. Like when you're in school, you should practice so that technically you're the best you can be. Know all your scales, know all your chords. You know, check if you're going to be a classical musician, check out from the music library and learn the parts to as many big pieces as you can. Like when the ballet is playing, I usually try to find out what they're playing for the season and look over the first flute parts or all the flute parts so I at least know, and if I get called to go in, I wouldn't be just totally sight reading. But often that's your one chance. You might get called to come in and sight read something.
Yep, work
and
ethic.
You have to be just a fearless sight reader. And I've been in several situations where someone comes in and they're just not ready, and that's their one chance.
Yep.
And then that was it.
Leslie Chin, you made the most of this one chance. The show is over, but you are an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce. I thank you very much for calling in. And I really don't want classical music to die. I love those regional symphonies like Peninsula and Vallejo and even the Oakland Civic Orchestra. Those are awesome things. And all those Broadway show musicians, some of them are really, really quite great when they do regional theater. So thank you for all you do, Leslie.
All right, thank you so much.
Take care. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Next week, I will, boy, it's going to be a very different show than this. I'm going to be talking with one of the brightest people I've ever read, Simon Winchester. He is the author of a pretty famous book called Professor and the Madman, and just out, The Perfectionist, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.